The following presentation is brought to you by The Realm Network.
The Bob Seska Show, presented by BubbleGenius.com.
Broadcasting from Resistance Headquarters,
relentlessly fighting back against the clown dictator and his regime of deplorables.
Never give up, never surrender.
This is The Bob Seska Show, presented by BubbleGenius.com.
From our nation's capital, it is Wednesday, October 3, 2018, and this is the Bob Seska Show, interviews from Earth One. My guest today is Helen O'Donnell. She's an accomplished author and historian, as well as the daughter of JFK's chief of staff, Kenny O'Donnell. You might know Kenny from Kevin Costner's portrayal of him in the excellent film 13 Days. Helen's new book is out now. It's Launching LBJ. Culled from Kenny O'Donnell's tapes and journals about the early days of the Johnson administration following Jack Kennedy's earth-shattering assassination in 1963. I'll provide links to Helen's new book in the comments below. By the way, please consider subscribing to our bonus content here on our Patreon page. Meanwhile, if you're like me, a student of the Kennedy years, you're going to love today's chat with Helen O'Donnell.
Hello.
Hi, Helen. It's Bob Seska.
Hey, Bob. How are you?
Great. How are you?
I'm good. I'm glad that got through okay.
It was an incredible honor to meet you in person at the Sexy Liberal Show a couple of weeks ago. And I want to start out with your new book, which just dropped yesterday. It's now available to purchase.
It's very exciting.
Yeah. It's called Launching LBJ. By the way, I'm going to include the Amazon link to your book in the description below this podcast. So if anyone wants to buy
wonderful.
The book, just go right there to the link just below this show, and you'll be able to click right over and pick up the book.
It was such an honor to meet you the other day, Bob, because I, we share so much in common in terms of interest in this period of time and these issues, you know. And I think especially today, more than ever, you know, the stories of these guys from the Kennedy years is more vital than ever, I think.
Yeah.
And Launching LBJ is my third book. And all of this material comes from my dad's tapes and diaries and notes and things like that we've had over the years. And what I have tried to do is pull them into sort of a story that takes us through the Kennedy years. And a great deal of the credit for some of this actually belongs to Chris Matthews from MSNBC, who I worked with on his book on JFK, because all of these tapes and all this material were sitting in boxes and no one realized the value of them. Mm-hmm. And Chris was doing his book and we sort of joined forces and he said to me, look, if you go through all those tapes, I'll help you. And that, when I started transcribing all the tapes, and it's, I can't tell you how many, I mean, it's hours and hours and hours, but you realize that you were really being taken behind the scenes of the Kennedy White House. He's such a wonderful raconteur that it's as if you're sitting in the Oval Office unseen, just watching it all unfold in front of you.
Right.
I
was just going to say,
it's just a fascinating story.
Real quick, I mean, before we dig into the book and everything, like, I got to ask you about Chris Matthews. What was it like to work in the same room with Chris Matthews? And you were a researcher on his book, obviously. And
he was terrific. He's so, he's smart as hell, you know. Mm-hmm. And his mind works so quickly that, you know, you have to stay on your toes to keep up with him. And he's sort of my dad's kind of guy because, you know, he's just sharp. And you know, he's also a real historian. So, you know, you have to know your stuff.
Yeah.
And the great thing about it was, you know, my dad has a particular viewpoint. And, you know, thanks to Chris, we got all this material transcribed and ready to use. But Chris has a sort of a viewpoint from a historical perspective. Mm-hmm. So when my dad talks about certain things, you know, Chris knows the background to a lot of it, which was tremendously helpful to me because I was, you know, I was a kid then. So, you know, he could really give it a perspective that was invaluable from my point of view.
So when you started working, on launching LBJ, what was the idea when you started to dig in as far as your dad's relationship with LBJ and how those early days of basically continuing the JFK administration, but after the assassination, where most guys stayed on, what inspired you to start through this period of time?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I jokingly say to people that I think that my dad actually, you know, almost wrote this book in a way because I really was not fascinated by LBJ that much.
Yeah.
And I had, and my last book came up, The Irish Brotherhood. And I, you know, I was familiar like we all are with LBJ, but I never thought about my dad's relationship with him. Mm-hmm. And I went to give a speech at my old school about my last book, The Irish Brotherhood. And I had left some material there from when I was at school, and in this box of books was one of my dad's books on and it was a contemporary, you know, written about 1966 on LBJ, by Bob Novak and Rolly Evans. And my dad had all these notes in it, and I thought, oh, this is just uncanny, you know.
Wow.
So that made me go back to the tapes, and from there, this idea of telling a very focused story about, you know, from Dad and Bobby's perspective, from the assassination to, say, March 1965, and how these three guys with really differing agendas, and, you know, they weren't, you know, LBJ was not, didn't get along with Bobby, and my dad had a you know, tense relationship with him, but how they, these three men, were able to put aside their own personal, you know, feelings and emotions and come together for the good of the country.
Yeah.
And to me, that's a great story because especially if you look at politics today, we don't see that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Very rarely, you know, everybody's making a big deal about what Jeff Flake did the other day because it's so shocking when somebody takes a stand that's not in their self-interest.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to tell a story about these guys when that was expected in politics.
Yeah.
And that's what they did. And they really came together because the country was in shock when President Kennedy was killed. And, you know, these guys had to stabilize it.
Yeah.
And that's what they moved to do. And also, you know, Dad and Bobby had their own agenda. So, you know, they were still, you know, as I said at one point in the book, the Kennedy administration was still in operation even while LBJ was president.
Right.
You know? And so it's an interesting relationship of how they each are trying to promote their own positions.
Yeah, he had LBJ had such a different approach in almost every way than President Kennedy had, and that must have been, I mean, the word shock barely begins to describe what that experience must have been like. And I want to get back to the period right after the assassination here in a second, but you know, moving just beyond that, I can't even imagine the level of heartbreak. But once your dad got beyond that, what was it like for him to have to recalibrate in order to adjust to running the LBJ White House versus the JFK White House?
Well, you know, there's a great scene when he's finally, you know, it takes him a long time, and both he and Bobby, quite some time to finally pull it together and go back to work after the murder of President Kennedy. And there's this marvelous scene in the book where it's his first day back, and he sort of goes to the White House gates and he can't stomach it, so he ends up walking up to Arlington and then walking back. And he walks, he finally gets into the Oval Office, and he talks about how shocking it was to him because he walked in and, you know, things were moving. LBJ's people were in place, they were making decisions, they were making phone calls, they were doing what had to be done. And my dad was sort of shocked in a way because he said he was numb is the word he used.
Yeah.
Because in John Kennedy's White House, you know, nobody moved without checking with my father.
Sure.
And it was this moment of realizing that, you know, things have changed, you know, that much that these guys have a country to run, you know, and they can't wait on you, you know. And so he talks about going in and sitting down with LBJ for the first time, and he said that Johnson, and this is after their discussion on the plane, I mean, they've been through a lot at this point, but he said, you know, LBJ said all the right things. He talked about, you know, I need Bobby to call Martin King. We need to do this and this and that on the civil rights bill. But my dad said he was sitting there thinking, I don't know if I can do this. Yeah. I don't know if I can recalibrate, you know, to use your word, and serve another president, because I was so hand in glove with John Kennedy. I just wasn't sure I could make the transition. And it's a very poignant story, because the way he tells it, he almost places you in that moment. And in the end, he decides to stay because he and Bobby decide their obligation to John Kennedy is to stabilize LBJ, get the Kennedy agenda through Congress to the extent they can, and then they can move on. But that was what John Kennedy would want them to do. And that's the story of the book.
Was your dad and to an extent Ted Sorensen and all of the JFK crew, was that staff kind of shuffled to the background and more or less, maybe not publicly speaking, but maybe inside the White House, LBJ's staff kind of taking over and being a little bit more assertive on that front, leaving your dad and Sorensen and all the rest to kind of play these more, I don't know, emeritus roles in the White House versus hands-on. Was that the case, or was it simpatico from the beginning?
Now, Ted Sorensen went up at some point in here. He went to the Cape and was writing his book.
Yeah.
Because he just couldn't do it. So he went up and he advised, but he stepped away. And then what happened with my dad is he and Bobby, you know, and this book is written from Dad and Bobby's perspective, because I found it hard to sort of relate to Lyndon Johnson, because I just think he's a tough guy to really understand. So I wrote it from Dad and Bobby's perspective, and my dad decided that his job was to help Marvin Watson and Jack Valenti and all these guys get up to speed.
Yeah, Valenti was LBJ's. Valenti was LBJ's press secretary, right?
Yes, and my dad didn't really know them until really he said that the most he ever dealt with them and the first time he really had any major interaction was on November 22nd.
Yeah.
And so he had no animosity or anything like that. He just thought, I need to get them to a place where I can walk away.
So there was no turf war.
I can't stay.
There was no turf war between the LBJ staff and the JFK staff, right? Or was there?
No, not at all, because I think my dad was such a unique figure that he, you know, people several people said to me they were afraid of him. I don't know that that's true. They just had great respect for the role he played with John Kennedy. And maybe they were afraid of him to a degree, but the Johnson staff was very good about, you know, trying to respect my father's position.
Yeah.
And I think, again, it's another statement on, you know, and that's been sort of overlooked a lot. And I think it's another statement about a group of people that are able to put themselves above partisan politics and, you know, sort of the ego. They understood that they all had a mission, which was to help the country move forward. And that's how LBJ put it. You know, we have to work together to help the country move forward. And I think, Bob, what's interesting is, you just don't see that anymore in politics.
Yeah. So when...
Now, at a certain point, it did start to change. I mean, there's a great story in the book where LBJ, Johnson calls together all the different cabinet secretaries and everything else, and, you know, sort of gives them hell about, you know, not getting his name in the newspaper enough. And Pierre Salinger was so distressed that he called my father at home and said, you know, I can't stand stay if he, because under Kennedy's administration, you know, that just wouldn't happen unless it went through my dad and then to Pierre. But, you know, the president never went around anyone.
Yeah.
And, but my dad was much more patient with things like that than I think it was easier for him because he knew he and Bobby had an agenda.
Right.
And a plan.
What was, and of course, Bobby Kennedy stayed on as Attorney General into the early years of the Johnson White House as well. But what was your dad's relationship like with LBJ? I mean, because we've heard all these stories about how bombastic he could be, how confrontational he could be. I mean, he obviously was in almost every way opposite of JFK in style and approach and personality. So how did your dad get along with LBJ personally? I mean, what do you, because we all know, obviously, there's the public face of the administration and the continuity between the two administrations after a terrible tragedy. But your dad must have had something to say behind the scenes about LBJ's style. Most people have who ended up meeting LBJ at one point or another.
Well, he, you know, it's very funny because my dad was very clear on his, you know, in this we try to make clear in the book, on his stories of LBJ, that they got along very well. You know, they would have, at the end of the day, they'd have a couple drinks in the Oval Office, and you know, and my dad said they got along very well on a social level because LBJ felt that he could speak sort of the truth around my dad, and it wouldn't go anywhere else. I mean, he knew it would go to Bobby,
yeah,
but it would never go anywhere else. But I think what's evident to me as I was writing this book is it's clear you can see this evolution in my dad's thinking where it's just too much of an adjustment for him to go from, you know, this extraordinary relationship. He said his relationship with John Kennedy was one in a million.
Yeah.
You know, it just, those things don't happen in life very often. To the relationship with LBJ, which, you know, LBJ liked to play people off each other, and, you know, he'd say one thing to one person, something to someone else, and, you know, Jack Kennedy was never like that. You know, my dad was his right-hand guy, you know, so anything he had to say went to my dad first. So I think that was really an adjustment for my father, and at one point, he and Bobby are having lunch at San Sushi down on Connecticut Avenue, and they just feel that this adjustment is too hard for both of them.
Yeah.
You know, for Bobby, it's too painful.
Mm-hmm.
And for my dad, he just feels this is not what he, this is not to his strength.
Yeah.
You know, and he tried very hard, but I think that LBJ was so different that it just was hard for him. I don't think he ever successfully kind of made the transition.
Yeah.
But I think he said on a social level, he enjoyed being around him.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just that politically, you know, he would tell you, I'm going to do this, this, and this. And then he'd tell, you know, Bob down the hall, I'm going to do da-da-da-da-da after just telling you something else.
Yeah, yeah.
And my dad just couldn't work that way.
Mm-hmm.
And he said this. The great thing about these tapes is my dad says right on them, you know, he said this to the president. He said it directly to Johnson. You know, I can't work this way.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got to stop doing that or I'm not going to stay. And so I think Johnson respected him on that front.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what was your dad was a political advisor primarily, worked on JFK's campaign in 1960, and then was mainly a political advisor for President Kennedy. What was the, in your estimation, and certainly drawn from your dad's tapes and writing, what was the biggest challenge with LBJ politically speaking in that first bunch of months that obviously he's thrown into this job? He immediately has to start running for president in 64.
Right.
And he rode a wave of popularity that was started by President Kennedy, but there had to be political liabilities going in too, because you're going to have a lot of people who are disillusioned, who don't have the same fervor for LBJ as they maybe had for JFK. So going into this brand new, well, technically it was still the Kennedy administration, but with new leadership, what was the biggest challenge in getting LBJ from November 22nd, 1963, all the way up to Election Day 1964?
Well, it's a great question, because what my dad talks about a lot is that John Kennedy and LBJ were very different people politically.
Yeah.
And, you know, we all know that how LBJ ended up on the ticket is, and this story I cover in the book, you know, sort of from my dad's point of view, how he actually ended up on the ticket and why he ended up there. And so, you know, his politics were much more conservative than Jack Kennedy's. And although, you know, conservative in those days, not in today's terms,
yeah.
You know. And so I think what was the biggest challenge that my dad and Bobby faced was getting LBJ to stick with Jack Kennedy's agenda and his politics, and not to be pulled by his own advisors in a different direction. He said that LBJ had great instincts, you know, in terms of pushing Kennedy's agenda. But, you know, he also had his own sort of viewpoint about how to get from here to there,
mm-hmm.
and in terms of the Senate and his approach. And that was something that was a real challenge for my dad and Bobby, was, you know, keeping Jack's agenda at the forefront,
mm-hmm.
and not allowing that to be sidetracked. Because LBJ had his own, you know, sort of view of what, you know, the Great Society and all these things that he had long wanted or envisioned for the country.
Mm-hmm.
And what my dad and Bobby wanted to do is, you know, for the next year, just focus on getting John Kennedy's priorities through.
Right.
And getting successfully reelected. And if you do that and we stabilize you, then you can run with the ball. You can do whatever you have to do, but you got to get there first.
Exactly.
And I think that was the biggest challenge for him.
Yeah.
And at one point, and this wouldn't happen today because I don't think it's legal, but the other thing that happened is my dad also went over and was executive director of the Democratic National Committee while serving in the White House. And
wow.
So it's an interesting story, because not only was he guiding kind of Johnson legislatively on civil rights and all these other issues, he was also running the campaign with, you know, Dick McGuire and John Bailey and all these guys, you
yeah.
know. So you couldn't do that today, but it's fascinating, because they were really, they ran the campaign. They knew what the numbers they wanted to run up for Johnson.
Yeah.
And to make him, you know, it wasn't hard against Barry Goldwater, but you still have to actually do it.
Yeah.
And then the other thing, too, is that he felt very strongly that they had to, and you can argue whether this was right or wrong later, but getting Hubert Humphrey was something that Bobby and Dad really pushed for.
Interesting.
Because they felt that Humphrey was the closest to Jack Kennedy's political views,
mm-hmm.
and that once he and Bobby left, that Humphrey could kind of keep LBJ on track.
Interesting.
And keep him in John Kennedy's kind of footsteps, if you will, and not be drawn into the more conservative side of the party.
And you mentioned you mentioned civil rights just a second.
It's an interesting story, Bob. You know, it's just interesting. I never knew that till I wrote this.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you mentioned civil rights a second ago. How involved was your dad as far as advising the president on the Civil Rights Act, which was passed not too many months after the assassination? I imagine that was the first big priority item for LBJ going into that term. I mean, Vietnam aside, what kind of challenges did your dad face politically for the White House at that point?
Well, you know, it's interesting, because my dad, that first conversation when he first comes back to work, the first thing that Johnson said to him is, you know, I need Bobby to call Martin King. We need to get him online
yeah.
and get this bill through, and I want to do it for him, you know, for Jack. And my dad said, you know, it was clear to him that Johnson didn't need to be told this had to be done. You know,
yeah.
this was, he understood that getting the civil rights bill through would, you know, really would seal his reelection, if you will.
Yeah.
And so he said that really, Johnson deserves full credit for, you know, picking up the ball and running with it. And, you know, my dad said all these guys afterwards who took credit for it, it's sort of not really appropriate, in the sense that nobody needed to tell LBJ that if you don't get this through, you're not going to win. You've got to get this through, and you've got to get it through as is. You know, you can't compromise. And, you know, Johnson had tried previously to get a civil rights bill through and lost it.
Yeah.
And so what my dad talked about is that the guy who really helped him push it through is, and he doesn't get much credit according to my dad, but the guy who really pushed it was Larry O'Brien, mm-hmm. who was another member of the Irish Mafia.
Yeah, yep.
And O'Brien was the legislative guy for Kennedy and a brilliant fellow. And, you know, he and Johnson really combined to get this done. And my dad and Bobby handled the political side.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's a hell of a team.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, it's just it was such a such a dream team at that period of time, and so many successes to get racked up. Did your dad ever react to LBJ's approach to Vietnam? I mean, this obviously, it really escalated out of control once your dad had already left the White House around, what, 1965? And is that accurate? I'm just recalling based on...
No, you're absolutely right. And as a matter of fact, and I cover this in the end of the book, that my dad had a conversation in 62 with Jack Kennedy and said to him, you know, he was dead against the war from the beginning. Mm-hmm. And both he and Jack were war heroes. They'd fought, you know, they were not like a lot of these guys. They knew what it takes to win and what we can and can't accomplish. And they didn't accept what the military said at face value.
Yeah.
And what my dad said on you know, and this would cover in the book, is that Johnson didn't question the military. Mm-hmm. I mean, if they said, and he didn't question McNamara. And, you know, Jack Kennedy thought McNamara was brilliant, but he didn't take what he said at face value. He didn't take anybody's. After the Bay of Pigs, he learned his lesson.
Yeah.
And he thought the biggest difference between Jack Kennedy and Johnson on Vietnam was that Johnson never questioned these guys.
Interesting.
And, you know, he said to one of the conversations he had with Johnson towards the end of my dad's time there, was that, you know, you can't listen to these guys, and once they drag you in it, it's going to be very hard to get out because they'll set it up so you can't easily withdraw without looking foolish.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And he said Johnson just didn't want to hear it because he believed, you know, these guys with all the stars and the uniform, you know, they must know what they're doing.
Yeah.
And he, you know, unlike Jack and my dad, you know, he didn't have the military background of fighting in a war, and he also hadn't, you know, he'd been there for the Bay of Pigs, but he didn't take the same lessons from it that Jack and Bobby and my dad did. And, you know, what they took from the Bay of Pigs was, you know, man, you can't take these guys at face value. I don't care how wonderful they are and how many stars they have.
Do you think that was because JFK was cozier with the military than President Kennedy was? Is that why? Or what linked LBJ more closely with military advisors? Was it, and even, I mean, the fact that LBJ had, as you said, been through the Bay of Pigs and also the Cuban Missile Crisis there in the room, it seems to me as if they came away from it with different takeaways, where President Kennedy was a little more skeptical of his military advisors, right, and LBJ embraced them a little more. Is that accurate?
No, that's absolutely accurate. You know, it's interesting because this is what my dad thought is. He said that, and again, we cover this in the book, is that there was an insecurity to Lyndon Johnson that my father didn't understand. My father and Bobby were both, you know, they were legitimately tough guys, you know, not fake tough guys like we have today in politics. These guys, you know, they were very tough, and Jack Kennedy was tough. And they had no insecurities at all. And I think my dad felt that Johnson was underneath, and he shouldn't have been, because he said he was this brilliant tactician in terms of legislation. Mm-hmm. That's how he was able to get the Civil Rights Bill through so quickly and all of this. But he had this underlying insecurity that really sort of made him decide differently on each situation. And my dad could never figure that out because he just didn't share it. And he said, you know, he would talk to these generals and he just didn't have the sense of self to stand up to them and say what Jack would say, which is, what the hell are you talking about?
Yeah.
You know, that doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah.
And Johnson just didn't question them, and he felt that it underneath, you know, this sort of, he really was a brilliant man. He just didn't seem to know that himself, which is kind of sad. And I think that's how, you know, underlying Vietnam, I think that's how we got deeper and deeper, because he didn't have the courage to stand up to these guys. And then I think what my dad said is true. Once you get drawn in, it's harder and harder to get out without losing face, especially in those days. Although I think that's true now. We're still in Afghanistan, you know.
And the big obvious question that everyone has is the revisionist historical question, which is that if Kennedy had lived, if he had not been murdered, did your dad think that pulling out of Vietnam was in the cards if President Kennedy had survived?
He actually said there was no question about it. He and Jack talked about it right before they went to Texas. And Jack said as soon as he was eminently practical politician when it came down to it. He wanted to win first, you know.
Yeah.
And Jack said as soon as the election's over, and he knew he was going to be running against Barry Goldwater, mm-hmm. although Goldwater wasn't announced at that point.
Yeah.
But Jack was dying to run against Goldwater. But he said as soon as I win the election, then we're out of there. Because he just was head become convinced there was no way they could win.
Yeah.
And I wanted to kind of confirm this. And for my first book, A Common Good, which is about the friendship of Bobby and my dad, mm-hmm. I was able to interview Mike Mansfield, and he was sort of very much at the end of his life, but he was still sharp as could be. And he said, he confirmed for me, he said he sat in the Oval Office with my dad and Jack, And Jack made very clear that he was out of there as soon as he got through the election.
Yeah.
Because he said, then I don't care. I have nothing to lose, and I don't care if I lose face because I'm not going to run again.
Yeah.
And now, my dad said he made this all very clear to Johnson, but he said that Johnson wasn't hearing that, you know, because he at this point was focused on winning re-election, and he was focused on the domestic agenda. And the end of Launching LBJ, my dad very poignantly says, you know, that the last time he finally realizes in March 65 he can't stay on because he's constantly caught between Johnson's agenda and Bobby's. You know, Bobby's now up in running for Senate. And he said that when he told President Johnson he was going to leave to go to Massachusetts and run for governor, that Johnson got so mad at him he never spoke to him again. And so he was never able to really sort of close the loop in terms of his feelings on Vietnam with Johnson personally, mm-hmm.
right.
which is kind of too bad.
By the way, Mike Mansfield was the Senate Majority Leader throughout most of the 60s and 70s. I mean, he's a pretty big-time politician at that point in time in the Democratic establishment. So I just wanted to fill in that quick blank.
Yes, and then he became, what was he, ambassador to Japan when I interviewed him.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
He had been in... at the end, but I forget how, you know, that was sort of, he was in his 90s when I spoke to him, but he was sharp as could be. And my dad had already talked about that conversation publicly, but I just wanted to hear it from Mansfield's point of view, and it mirrored what my dad said exactly.
So,
and it was the last time they discussed, no, actually, that's not true. The last time they discussed Vietnam was... Jack was talking about the plans he had upon return from Dallas. And the reason he wanted to return as quickly as he did is he had a meeting with the ambassador from Vietnam here in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted to discuss sort of plans for withdrawal. And, of course, that meeting obviously never happened.
Yeah, yeah. So let's rewind a little bit, Helen. Tell me about your dad's friendship with Bobby and Jack and how they hooked up. And then speaking more specifically, what your dad's first impressions were of President Kennedy after they met, because obviously the entree into President Kennedy for your dad was obviously Bobby Kennedy. So how did this Irish mafia get started? When did they all first link up and become friends?
Well, it's a great story because my dad was at Harvard. He went to Harvard. His dad was a football coach at Holy Cross, and my dad came back from the war, and he didn't want to go to Holy Cross because his dad was a coach there. So he went to Harvard, and he was playing. He was quarterback and captain of the football team and was a real star. Many of his records remained unbroken for a very long time. And Bobby came to go to Harvard, and his dad told him to look up my father because it turned out that his father and my grandfather went to Boston Latin School together, which is just amazing. I never had known that. So Bobby and my dad met at Harvard, and they just kind of hit it off because they were sports nuts and political nuts, you know. And they would talk, you know, politics while throwing the football around at night.
Of course, they went over to Tobin's house to lift weights with PJ and Squee.
I got that as you were saying it. I thought, I don't think that was his name. I got that, but I'm a little slow.
I'm sorry to interrupt. You were saying
I don't think they had any PJs or Squeed. They didn't
I seriously doubt it. But you were saying about meeting at your dad and Bobby Kennedy meeting up at Harvard and playing football together.
They met at Harvard, and I'm laughing because I'm now trying to think of their other friends who had these odd names. Maybe it is a sports thing. I don't know. But anyway, Bobby was dying for my dad to meet his older brother Jack, who he just was enamored of, you know. And my dad was pretty skeptical at first because he thought, you know, what do I want to meet your older brother for? And they met at the Bellevue Hotel, the famous Bellevue Hotel in Boston. And the first time they met, they actually didn't like each other, which is kind of a funny thing if you think about it. And then the second time, and Bobby was just crushed, so he pushed and pushed for them to meet again. And the second time they met, they ended up talking about, surprise, surprise, sports. And that was kind of their entree. And from then on, they never looked back. And so he was with, you know, he was with Jack from really, I would say, you know, he would say 1950. I don't think he wasn't really involved in the 46 campaign, but, you know, it was more after that. And he and Jack just developed this marvelous relationship, though it took time. And Bobby was, you know, my dad's best pal forever and ever. So that's how that all sort of got underway. And that's what my first two books cover. And so it's kind of, it's a great story of, it's really a guy's story. You know?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting in terms of our historical perspective of JFK himself as an intellectual, because you see a lot of reports, contemporaneous reports at the time, of people kind of not regarding JFK as necessarily the intellectual of the Kennedy brothers, or the guy who was most tapped into the bloodstream of American politics, that he was more aloof and kind of separated from that. But, you know, when you really think about President Kennedy in context of all presidents, or of all political leaders, especially when you're looking at modern politics, he was very much an intellectual. He was an amazing writer, and he saw and recognized the enormous talents of some of the people around him. And we go back to Ted Sorensen, who was one of the great political writers of all time. Certainly your dad, certainly his, you know, JFK's brother, Bobby, and so on. And that kind of gets lost because we think about JFK just in terms of those couple of years in the White House and not in terms of the broader context. Was your dad cognizant of how smart JFK actually was, how talented he was for communicating?
And what I was going to say is, you know, I think you're quite correct. In those early days, people didn't take Kennedy very seriously. They didn't take Jack seriously, but he wasn't very serious in the early days. So they didn't take him seriously because he just hadn't made kind of that, what my dad called that turn in the road when he decided, you know what, I'm going to get serious about this. And I think really when that happened was the 52 campaign. And, you know, when he won, and that was when my dad said that was really when you began to see, you know, this guy has the stuff to go all the way. He's, you know, he's brilliant, and he just has this great political instinct, but he was also tough as nails. And what's interesting is that I think he had, you know, Ben Bradley said to me once, he had this ability to sort of, this is Jack, to kind of hover over everybody so that he always seemed sort of a step ahead and slightly removed from everybody and everything that was happening around him. You know, sort of like he always saw the next step in on the ladder before anybody else did. And Ben thought that was one of his most, you know, really understated, if you will, gifts, because in a politician, that's a wonderful thing to have, is to sort of always know where you need to put your foot next. and the judges had that great instinct, that great gut. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I think was important is he had these brilliant guys, not just like my dad, but Larry O'Brien and, mm-hmm. as you say, Ted Sorensen and Pierre came later and, you know, was not quite as much as the inner circle as those other guys were. But what struck me the most about all of them is their devotion to Jack. They were all brilliant on their own, but they were able to set their egos aside and come together to support this man's success.
Yeah.
And that doesn't happen very much in politics anymore, if you think about it.
Yeah, I know.
You can't, you know, these guys go into the White House and they're already calling their editor for their next book, and they haven't even stepped foot to the door yet.
Yeah, sure.
And, you know, they're calling, you know, NBC to get their show lined out. You know, in those days, these guys who were, you know, and you met Ted Sorensen, but man, was an intellectual giant.
Oh, God, yes.
They were, I mean, he was a giant. And all of them were able to put aside their egos because they saw that Jack Kennedy was, you know, a brilliant guy that could change the country.
Mm-hmm.
And they came together to support him. And I think that is one of Jack Kennedy's most brilliant qualities that it doesn't get a lot of attention, is his ability to bring people together like that. That's a real skill.
And your dad was known as, and this is his most famous nickname, I assume, is the Cobra. Your dad was nicknamed the Cobra. When people talk about
that, among other things.
Yeah. What were some of the other nicknames? There was one that I was trying to remember that I think Jackie had for your dad, and I couldn't quite remember what that was. Sort of like gatekeeper or something, like he was known as the gatekeeper.
Yeah, and it's very funny because Jackie used to say that everybody refers to my dad as, you know, the Kennedy political consigliere, but unlike, you know, dopey Trump's guy, my dad actually knew what the word meant and actually did the job, you know, successfully.
Yeah.
In fact, Jack Kennedy's right-hand tough, you know, SOB.
In fact, he had
no problem playing that role.
You were mentioning Trump's guy, who I think you were talking about, Steve Bannon. I think your dad was actually, in terms of his role...
No, I was talking about that fool, Michael Cohen.
Michael Cohen. Oh, okay.
A political consigliere. He wouldn't know how to spell the word.
That's right. Sorry. I mean, I was thinking in terms of... I mean, Steve Bannon as a political advisor for Trump until he was fired is, I think, more along the lines of what your dad was for JFK, more of a political strategist.
Well,
is that correct?
Well, he wishes he was. My dad wouldn't let him through the, you know, he wouldn't have gotten through the gate. You know what I mean? Let's be serious.
Sure.
These guys, none of them would have gotten through the gate.
Yeah.
And you know, these are just, you know, these are foolish people. They don't know what they're doing.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, and so... These guys were at a different level, one of the things Jackie used to say when my dad walked in the room, it always meant that Jack had to go back to work.
Ah.
And so she called him, the name you're reaching for, she called him the Wolfhound.
Ah, that's it, that's the one.
It meant my dad was, you know, he was all business. He was tough as nails.
Yeah.
And there's a great story during the campaign. They were, you know, they're on the bus and they're in Vegas and they decide to stop for the night because they're all exhausted and Jack wants a break. And all the press is there, you know, they're all there and they have this great time. The Rat Pack puts on a show. And then there's a private party afterwards, and one of the press guys said to me, you know, we're the White House press corps. We're pretty impressive people, you know, and we're sitting down there, and we've all had a few pops. And he said, your father walked in the room. He signaled to the band to cut the music, so they stopped. And he said, your father looked at everyone and said, okay, well, that's it. We're shutting down for the night. All of you take your drinks, go to your room. That's it. We don't want to see you till the morning.
Wow.
And he said, you know, nobody questioned him. Everybody got their little drinks and went to their rooms.
Yeah.
And because Jack was going to have a private party with Frank Sinatra and the gang afterwards,
Jesus.
And he didn't want the damn press reporting on it.
Sure.
And I looked at him and I said, it never occurred to you to say no? He said, oh, hell no. Your father would have thrown me off the bus.
There you go.
He would have left me. He said a couple times he left people behind. He said they gave him a hard time. He just left them behind.
So it seems to me as if your dad had to develop a really close relationship with guys like Ben Bradlee from the Washington Post, of course, and other, obviously, the White House press corps. because of certain, let's say, political liabilities for President Kennedy. Was that something your dad had to constantly focus on? Like, how do I keep President Kennedy's women away from the press? Or was it just an open secret, obviously? I think that's the...
My dad talks about this, and it's a great honest answer, I think, because, you know, everybody sort of tries to baloney around this issue, but, you know, my dad was a straight shooter. He didn't care what you thought. he was asked about this, and what he said at the time, these tapes are contemporary. They were done after the White House years, so I want to say 65, 66. Mm-hmm. So he's very sharp at this point. And what he said is that he and Jack had an understanding. Mm-hmm. You know, my dad's role was to be his political right-hand guy, his consigliere, his guy to advise him what to do and to keep him out of trouble. And he said, I'd say to him, look, you can't do X, Y, and Z. Mm-hmm. And he said, Jack would look at me and sometimes he'd listen. And he'd say, okay, well, you're right about that. And sometimes I'd tell him, look, you can't go do X, Y, and Z. And he'd look at me and he'd say, go to hell. And, you know, and he said, my father said I would look at him and go, yes, sir.
And sure.
That was it.
Yeah.
He's the president or he's a senator, you know. And he said, my belief was, look, I'm not his nanny. I'm his political right-hand guy. I can tell you what I think you should do. I can tell you what I think you shouldn't. But he's a man. Mm. You know, he can tell me yes or he can tell me to go to hell, and I have to respect that.
Right.
You know, and he said, but he would never, bullshit for him with the press. He would just tell them, get out.
Yeah, yeah.
Because then there's nothing and they always left because in those days, you know, they didn't dare cross. You know, what Sandy Van Oker said to me is, we just didn't dare cross your father. He would just, like you said, he'd kick someone off the bus and leave him somewhere.
That's right. So,
and he wouldn't do that just to the press, Bob. He did that to Kennedy family members, too.
Do you have any memory of those years, Helen, when your dad was working in the White House?
No. I was born, I was, you know, and it's funny because everybody asked me, and this is kind of a funny story because it gives you a sense of their relationship.
Yeah.
When I was born, my dad was they were in, I want to say Nassau with Macmillan, who was the Prime Minister of England. And they were, and I'm getting some stupid thing on the phone, sorry.
Oh, that's weird.
And they were in Nassau for this meeting.
Oh, you know what that is?
My mother was pregnant with...
That, you know what that is, Helen? That is the president texting everybody. That is Trump's text that went out to every cell phone. That's what that noise was. Thank you.
It'll just screaming help, probably.
That's right. Yeah. I got to figure out how to block the president from texting me from now on. So I'm sorry. Go ahead. That noise was annoying, of course.
Well, get him off my phone, too. But I was born around that time. My dad was with the president, of course. He's always with the president.
Mm-hmm.
And so my dad got a call and they're in a meeting. It's Macmillan and Jack, and my dad was always in the room for everyone, from Khrushchev to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't say anything. He just, as you know, hung back and listened. And then after these meetings, Jack would kind of download what he was thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And all of this is all on the tape. That's how we have this rich information. But he said that, he got a call and he went and he took the call. He interrupted. He had to leave the meeting to take this call. And he came back in the room and then he just stood there with his arms folded, didn't say anything. And Jack looked at him and said, well, was it a boy or a girl? What happened? Is she okay? And my father said, oh, yeah, she had the baby.
Wow.
And Jack said, was it a boy or a girl?
Mm.
And my father said, oh, I forgot to ask.
Wow.
And
so,
Jack was like, what do you mean you forgot to ask?
And so were you...
Remember, you know, he and Jackie had trouble having children. You know, we had five. So, you know, my father was a little less, oh my goodness, another baby, you know?
Right,
so,
right.
Jack picked up the phone and called my mother at the hospital
and so,
wanted to know what the baby was.
Were you named after your mom or was Helen just a family name?
Yes.
Oh, you were? Oh, that's great. Wow.
I was named after my mom. And And my mother loved telling that story because it drove my father crazy because he really didn't ask. And Jack Kennedy called her, which, of course, she loved, and was all excited, wanting to know it was a boy or a girl and everything else, and asked her all these questions. And she said, you know, Kenny didn't ask me any of that, not her weight, not whether it was a boy or a girl, nothing.
You know? Right. Well, so let's dig into the missile crisis, Helen, because this is obviously where I think your dad's overall recognizability as a member of the administration really hit a high watermark with the movie 13 Days, where Kevin Costner played your dad. And it's literally maybe among my top three or four favorite political movies of all time. It's just so well done.
It is a great movie, isn't it?
Yeah.
It really is.
And of course, your dad is shown to be heavily involved and a member of XCOM, which is the Executive Committee of the National Security Council that really guided and made a lot of the decisions and really mulled over all of the details in terms of contingency plans and how to approach the missiles in Cuba, and then of course the quarantine and all the back and forth that occurred around that. But some historians have actually disputed how involved your dad was, and I think those of us who know about your dad and have read about your dad, and certainly you, listening to his tapes and reading his writing from that time, how deeply involved was he? I imagine more so than some of the critics have said. But where do you land on all of that?
Well, you know, it's interesting because that movie, my brother Kevin was actually involved in that movie.
Yeah.
And the script from that movie was written from one side, part of it was written from one side of my dad's tapes on the Cuban Missile Crisis. So they had sort of direct access to that particular section of his tapes. And so they decided to do the movie from my dad's perspective because Kevin Costner, whom I don't really know, but this is just my understanding of it, is he wanted to portray it from dad's perspective because he was not only in on every meeting, but he was sort of an everyman. You know, my dad was that blue-collar guy that could speak to these issues for the average everyday guy and could relate to them. And what my dad would say and what I found on the tapes is that he was in every single meeting and he was involved intimately in all the details, but he was not the guy, you know, he was the guy, as in everything you did with Jack Kennedy, he was the guy, you'll see him in these photos leaning back, you know, he's in the background with his arms folded, he just listens. And then after everybody left, then he and Bobby and Jack would sit down and hash it out. And my dad said that was his role. He said, I was kind of, you know, I would reflect what I heard.
Yeah.
And I would tell Jack, you know, he never called him that. He called him the president. But he said, I would tell him exactly what I thought. And, you know, if I thought somebody was full of crap or had their own agenda, I'd tell him that. And he would, just like everything else, Jack would listen and then he would make a decision. And the same thing with Bobby. Bobby, you know, gets enormous credit, as he should, but Jack was the decider.
Yeah.
And my dad is very clear on the tapes. Our role was to just, you know, it was kind of to be his sound barrier, you know, whatever he would listen to everybody and then ask, we'd download what we thought we heard.
Yeah.
And I think what's different is, you know, that you can't really easily portray that in a movie because you can't. And it doesn't help you if your star of the movie is just leaning against the wall, not saying too much during critical scenes.
Well, you know, actually, you know, the portrayal in the movie, in contrast, or in fact, in comparison with what you have described, is pretty damn close. I mean, in the movie, they didn't.
That was what he was.
Yeah.
You know, that was his role.
Right. Yeah, that's of course what I'm getting at.
Costner had access to some of this material. So, and as I said, I don't want to misrepresent it. I don't know Mr. Costner, but he created the character from the actual tape. So the only difference really was my father didn't have that Boston accent, but his role in that movie is very accurate because he's going by my dad's own stories.
Oh, see, you know, that's fascinating. When you say that your dad didn't actually have that Boston accent, which Kevin Costner had, that of course makes me think, and this is more along the lines of filmmaking, but you know, Kevin, the worst thing about that movie is Kevin Costner's Boston accent. So I'm wondering, like, why did he put on a Boston accent?
He did not have that. He actually, the Kennedy accent drove him crazy, which is very funny, and I don't know why he decided to have the accent.
Yeah,
you know, I guess he likes accents. Somebody said to me he likes accents.
Well, my friends and I always make fun of, there's one line right at the beginning of the movie that Kevin Costner delivers, and it's the one moment of that movie that takes us clean out of it, and Kevin Costner goes, "This is your report card," and it's so bad.
My dad, you have to hear some of the tapes, Bob, because he just doesn't see. He's quite articulate, actually, yeah. Because my grandfather was not only a football coach, but an English teacher at Holy Cross. So, you know, he is very, very clear on his pronunciation and everything else. And in listening to the tapes, it's marvelous because you just don't hear every once in a while certain words, but you don't hear that Boston twang.
Yeah.
But I think my grandfather maybe didn't allow it. No Boston twangs in the Worcester household.
There you go. You know, and how did your mom deal with the crisis? I mean, you must have talked with her before she died, and did this ever come up as far as experiencing, like, her husband being in the White House at the time when we came so dangerously close to basically the end of the world? How did your mom cope with all of that?
Well, it's interesting because my parents died the same year in 1977, and I was very young, and she was young. She was only 49, and he was only 53. So everything I've learned about them, I've learned from the tapes or from interviewing people, because I was young, and I don't really, you know, I was too young to sort of even be thinking about these things or talking to her about things like this.
Yeah.
And so I've interviewed some of my siblings, though, obviously, because they remember more because they're older, which I always remind them often and always. Anyway, they had said to me that it was, you know, it was just as it was portrayed in the movie. It was a very scary time.
Yeah.
And they had received orders of where all the, you know, the family should go and everyone else that, you know, most of the administration had. But my dad had not. And there's a marvelous scene in the movie where and that is actually from the tapes where you know, the Costner character is saying to his wife, you know, she said, "What am I supposed to do with your children?" And my dad and Bobby had decided they were gonna stay with the president.
Yeah.
Which meant that they would be safe. And they had not made arrangements. They were thinking, if it's the end of the world, we'll just stay here. We want to be with our kids. You know, there's no point in, you know, who are we kidding here, is what they were actually thinking.
Right.
And my mother said it was one of the most, just terrifying time. Because it really, you know, you just didn't know. It could be the end of the world. And I think it was something that he didn't fully understand how frightening it was for her.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he was in the middle of it.
Sure.
And, you know, for she and for Ethel, you know, they have all these kids, you know, and I think for he and Bobby, they just didn't ever understand till afterwards just how terrifying it was for the wives.
Yeah, yeah. And, of course, all the instructions for the families were mostly cosmetic, because it would have taken less time for the missiles to arrive than it would for you and your brothers, and your sister was born at the time, I assume, and your mom to get to.
Oh, yeah, we all were at that point. Yeah. But, you know, the funny thing is, this was the thing. My father, who had been through a war, you know, he and Jack understood this, and he said afterwards, and this is also on the tapes, that, you know, he didn't make these arrangements because who are we kidding? If it actually happens, there's no survival. But, you know, that's nice to say, but it's different if you're the mom with all the kids. The same thing for Ethel, you know. I don't know how many she had at that point, but, you know, it's easy for you to say in the White House, but it's tough if you're on the other end.
That's right.
But I think that, you know, he says on the tapes, it's an interesting thing. He said he and Bobby had a discussion, and they just had such confidence in Jack that, as scary as it was, they were absolutely confident that he would solve it.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, that's amazing. I mean, I can't say that about a president in, you know, that I can think of that I, you know, since I've been voting.
Yeah.
You know, these guys just had such confidence in him that he said, I never was absolutely flat out terrified because he always solved everything. It just never occurred to us he wouldn't solve this as well. Because he said he was so brilliant. And he said, Bobby and Jack were a couple of really smart guys. They'll take care of it.
Right, right.
And there's a great story, if I can tell you, and I don't think this is in, I don't think it's in the movie because, I hadn't found it yet on the tapes, so it didn't make it into that. But I found it while I was working on launching LBJ, and it was during the height of the crisis, and Bobby and Dad decide to go to get out of the White House. You know, they just have to, sometimes you got to get out of there, and you could in those days, you know. And they walk out and they decide to go down to Connecticut Avenue and get a bite to eat, get a burger or something. And they go in someplace, and of course my dad has a beer and Bobby has a milk, which Bobby, you know, he said Bobby frowned at him. You shouldn't be having a beer. We're in a crisis.
Wow.
So they, in typical, that's their relationship. And so they have their hamburger and they walk back and they, you know, there isn't much you can say, you know, they're waiting for the XCOM is meeting and all the stuff and Jack is coming down. And as they cross through Lafayette Park, and he, you know, he said that Bobby said to him, you know, I have this kind of crazy idea and I want to get a few minutes alone with my brother without anybody there.
Yeah.
And he said, can you arrange that? Can you stall everybody? And so, you know, my dad said, sure. I mean, you're his brother. Sure. If that's what you want, yeah, I'll stall everybody. He said, what's the idea? And he said, well, you're going to think it's stupid, but it's pretty simple. And what I think is that we should just, and this is when they were talking about the letters, which letter to believe.
Oh, yeah, right. There were two Khrushchev letters that were teletyped to the White House. One was less bellicose, and then there was a second one that was much more bellicose. And they decided to, I don't want to skip ahead too far, so I'm going to let you finish the story.
No, you're exactly right. And Bobby turns to my dad, and, you know, they had this sort of, you know, brotherly kind of give each other grief all the time relationship. Mm-hmm. And so Bobby said, you're going to think it's stupid. And you know, my dad looked at him and said, hey, Bobby, we're facing the end of the world. I mean, I would just throw the idea out there, you know. I mean, how
could
it be compared to where we are, right? Uh-huh. You know? And Bobby said, okay, well, this is what I think we should do. We should just, you know, ignore the bellicose letter, to use your beautiful word, to ignore that letter and just pretend we never got it and just accept the other one.
Yeah, exactly. And where did
And my dad looked at him and said, I think it's a great, what are you talking about? It's a brilliant idea. Go talk to your brother. And so they go in, and he said that, you know, he stalled everybody, and then the brothers talked. My dad said, I wasn't there. I don't know what they decided. But he said then they had the meeting, and Jack walks in and said, this is what we're going to do.
Mm-hmm. And so just backing up a couple of days, where did your dad land on the issue of quarantine versus airstrikes? Where did he what was his first instinct as far as which approach to take?
He thought the quarantine was the way to go because he thought the airstrikes would start, you know, you'd immediately start a war because he was a bombardier. So he understood that it doesn't matter what these guys tell you. You can't have 100% accuracy. Yeah. You're going to kill some Russians and, you know, Khrushchev is going to have to respond. Mm-hmm. That's just the way it goes. It's just, you know, this he said, and he says this on the tapes, you know, it's a bunch of bullshit. These generals saying, you know, we can pinpoint the airstrikes, we can do this and that. He said, you know, something always goes wrong.
Yeah.
And he said, I was a bombardier guy. I mean, he had this great story about once when he was in the plane and the bomb got stuck and he had to crawl down and kick it out and it fell out of the plane. You know, he said, you know, shit happens, you know, and you're going to kill the wrong guy. And then they're going to have to respond and it's too late.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what he meant, sort of jumping over a bit to the side, but it's what he meant about LBJ's problem with the generals, because he didn't question them because he didn't have the background, whereas he and Jack had the background to go, look, you know, something always goes wrong. You're going to kill, maybe you only kill two Russians, but that's all it's going to take.
Yeah, right. Right. And so,
you know, you could kill one and you have a world war, you know, that's what all it takes.
So your dad, and I don't think he gets enough credit for this, but I think your dad was instrumental in, of course, in association with Jack and Bobby, in creating a new international language between nations when it came to avoiding the eventuality of a nuclear confrontation. So there's a scene, in fact, in the movie 13 Days with Dylan Baker as Bob McNamara, where he's explaining to, I don't remember if it was the Joint Chiefs or whatever, he's saying that this back and forth between that were taking place with this quarantine around Cuba and the movement of the quarantine and how they stopped the ships as they approached the quarantine line and everything was in fact language. It was foreign policy language that was being created on the fly for the first time ever by, I think, that trifecta of minds between your dad and, of course, Bobby and the president. Do you see that in your dad's writing where does he acknowledge the fact that he's changed foreign policy forever at that point?
Yeah, you know, he does, and it's interesting. That's really a you know, wonderfully insightful point on your part, because this approach they had is how they approached all of their policy making, mm-hmm. you know, not only on the international, but also the domestic front, if you think about it. And it was this sort of roll your sleeves up, get the job done, kind of Kennedy-esque approach is really what it was.
Yeah.
And sometimes they were making it up as they went along.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Jack had a vision for what he wanted to do. And, you know, and it's sort of classic thing, my dad, you know, talking about even the nuclear, the whole issue, he said, you know, this is what I want. Yeah. I don't give a damn how you do it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care what you have to say. I don't care what term you have to use. Just this is the end result.
Yeah.
Get it done.
Right, right.
And that was the approach. And I think that it gave, he was, you know, Bobby and Jack had such brilliant people around him that he was confident giving them the ability to then go run with the ball. You know, you can't do that if you have a bunch of boobs around you, because you can't trust them.
Right.
But, you know, he was really careful to bring together these guys at all different levels. And he didn't agree with them on everything, but he knew that they had the skill set that he required of them in that job.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a great example of that, because, you know, you're not talking a small thing. They established a whole new role for the United States
yeah.
in the world order.
Mm-hmm.
That's not nothing.
Yeah. It's really a great lesson in nuance and pragmatism. Anyone who looks at the Kennedy administration, you have to zero in on the Cuban Missile Crisis, obviously, as being the seminal moment, not only in the Kennedy administration, but I think throughout American politics. It was really a turning point in terms of how we engage with other countries, and certainly other countries who have thousands of nuclear missiles pointed at us. And it's a level of nuance that I think gets lost in the modern context, certainly in this current administration.
And I think it does. And I think also, you know, it also gets lost because we don't think of it, because so many people, you know, sort of zero in on Vietnam, which is unfortunate, because it's why I think that my dad's correct that if Jack had lived, you know, that same sort of approach and nuance would have been his approach to Vietnam. He would never have gotten sort of dragged down that path, because he had a you know, as Ben Bradley said, he had a higher vision of where he wanted to take not only this mm-hmm. country, but the world.
Yeah.
And you know, and I think he was not afraid to execute it, because he had supreme confidence in his own ability, which mm-hmm. is another thing that a lot of presidents, you know, they need that, but they don't always have it.
Sure.
And it's funny, one of the things I wanted to say, and this sort of demonstrates it, though it's on the domestic front, if you remember back to when they were trying to get Meredith registered during the civil rights, you know, during that whole upheaval in the civil rights.
Yeah.
Era, and Bobby was on the phone, and there's this marvelous story on the tapes where, and it's the same thing that during the Cuban Missile Crisis, the same approach. You know, they're sitting there, Jack is sitting there on the phone, and, you know, they're managing this, you know, in that sort of Kennedy style of, you know, that what he called the hurry up offense, you know, get these guys in place, go do this, let's get this guy registered, let's do this, that, and the other thing. And this wonderful, one of Bobby's guys told this great story about, you know, it was a Saturday. And this just demonstrates the Kennedy approach to solving problems.
Yeah.
It was Saturday. He went in to do some extra work at the Justice Department. And Bobby walked by, and Bobby said, "You doing anything this afternoon?" And the guy was like, "Well, not really, just working here, you know, just catching my paperwork." Bobby said, "Great, come with me." And he said, "The next thing I knew, I was on an airplane headed down to Mississippi. And I'm told that I'm now in charge of the marshals and getting this guy safely in."
Yeah.
And he said, "I thought, what the hell? I'm a corporate lawyer from San Francisco. I don't know anything about this stuff." And Bobby said, "Oh, you'll figure it out. How hard can this be? Go."
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he said, "I'm sitting on the plane." He's this very short, he became a federal judge, short guy. And he said, "I thought..." He said, "Helen, I was so short that when I got there, I had to stand on a table so the marshals could see me when I was giving them orders. And I'm in my, you know, Saturday outfit, you know what I mean?" He said, "You know, so they were surprised to see me, but I was sent there by the Attorney General and the President." And he said, "I learned a couple of things when it comes to the Kennedys." He said, "And especially Bobby, which is when they say to you, 'What are you doing today?' never say nothing. Never, ever tell them nothing." And he said, "And if they say, 'Come with me,' always ask where."
That's so great. Oh, my God.
Isn't that a great story?
Yeah, absolutely. And there was one thing I wanted to mention, too. And this is another thing that I think gets lost over the generations. And certainly now in our modern perspective, we tend to think of foreign policy as a binary state. You're either weak on foreign policy, right, or you're strong on foreign policy. And what your dad was able to do with Jack and Bobby, I think, was establish a middle ground for foreign policy where you could be strong and you could also be conciliatory at the same time, where you could leave wiggle room to avoid a catastrophe. And I think we tend to lose sight of that because it's a little more difficult to grasp from a lay perspective or as a citizen perspective.
It is, you know, and it's funny. And also, Jack thought about things in a way that, you know, because, and maybe this is because they were in the war, but there's another great story on the tapes where he talks about Laos. And if you remember, that was another hot point for them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he said, you know, the generals came in and they wanted to send all this military stuff and blah, blah, blah. And my dad said, "Jack, you know, did what most presidents do in those circumstances, which is, okay, let's do this, this, and this." And then my dad started getting reports back, and he and the president had this conversation where we're sending all this military stuff, you know, out to them, and they're going to fight the war, and blah, 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 blah. Well, the guns we're sending are, because they're in stature smaller than American soldiers, everything we sent didn't work. It didn't fit for them. The guns were too long. Mm. The uniforms were too big. Nothing worked. And, you know, and Jack talked to my dad about the fact that, you know, a few weeks later, the generals come in and they want more.
Yeah.
And he said, "I looked at them and said, but I'm reading these reports that in the papers, these are newspaper reports, the stuff you're sending doesn't work. They don't fit. The guns are too big. The uniforms don't fit. These guys don't know how to operate the equipment. You know, it's sitting lined up in yards because they don't know what the hell the tanks do. They don't know how to turn them on." And the generals, and you're coming to me and you're wanting more of the same stuff. It's not working. Does it not occur to you that we need to reapproach this?
Yeah.
And he said the generals just looked at him like, no, that didn't occur to them. You know, I mean, it was like Kennedy, my dad called it the Kennedy think outside of the box approach to politics and international policy, which is, and it's something that we don't have at all now, you know, which is that, you know, let's just think outside the box and talk to people and see what's our best approach rather than just assuming if we are Americans and whatever we say is right, you'll figure it out.
Mm-hmm, right, right. So let me ask you at this point, Helen, because we've now been talking for an hour and 10 minutes, and of course I could talk for the next...
No.
Don't apologize. I'm about to apologize to you because we've gone so long, but I still have so much more I want to talk to you about. But if you need to take a break at all right now, we can stop, and of course I can cut all of this out of the final show. And so if you want to take a break, or if you need to go, we can start to wrap up at this point. I just wanted to check in and see how you were with time and energy level and so on. If you need to go take
a
bathroom break or something.
I just don't want to hold you because there's so much material, and sometimes, you know, I don't want to have you glaze over.
Well, no, you'll never get me to glaze over. Not on this topic. Never, ever, ever. So, you know, of course, as I said, I could keep talking with you about this for a long, long time, and I still have a few more topics that we can get into. So I just wanted to make sure that you were okay.
Oh, no, I appreciate it. To me, it's so interesting because I was so much younger, and, you know, my dad was, you know, my dad, but I just didn't know this side of him. So it's fascinating to me. And you know, honestly, I would have said to you that when I started this, like when Chris Matthews first talked to me about all this material, mm-hmm. I remember thinking, oh, my God, Jack Kennedy's been done and done and done. What new could we find? Mm-hmm. And, you know, Chris was right. The more you learn about Jack Kennedy through my dad's stories and tapes and everything, the more fascinated you become. I don't know how you feel, but I would love to have been able to spend just a few minutes with the guy. You know, for him to get people to do the things they did, you know, they really believed they could do anything when they were in his presence.
Yeah.
You know, we don't have presidents like that anymore.
No,
certainly not now.
I mean, it's my opinion that we, as Americans, throughout our history, we have faced three moments in which major, major potential for good work was lost. And that was when Reconstruction was shut down after the Civil War, where I think the South was allowed to backslide into a lot of things that led to, obviously, Jim Crow, neo-slavery, civil rights issues, and so on and so on and so on. Then there was another time, I think, and that was the death of President Kennedy, where an extreme amount of potential for changing the course of the world for the better was lost. And then, of course, the next one is 9/11, where I think what happened after 9/11 was a tragedy in and of itself, because we could have used 9/11 as a way to unite the world around things that would positively affect change and make the world a better place. Instead, we went into a couple of wars, and things became more divisive.
Still ongoing. We're still in Afghanistan.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean,
right. And
I
you
mean,
know,
it's, you know, my father would be appalled, but, you know, we're still in Afghanistan.
Yeah, I mean, staggering.
No clue as to how to get out. This is what he worried about, you know, things like that.
So let's talk about Dallas for a second. And your dad was in the motorcade, and he and Dave Powers had been interviewed after the fact by the Warren Commission, by Arlen Specter, in fact, specifically. And they told Arlen Specter that they heard three shots. And I'm not saying this to bring up some sort of controversy or to say who's wrong and who's right. I just want to get some information.
I cover all this in the book. So
right.
You have to be willing to talk about it.
Okay, well, perfect. So, but later, Tip O'Neill evidently had a conversation with your dad. And Tip O'Neill reported back, allegedly, that your dad said he heard two shots from the grassy knoll. And I want to get into the, you know, where your dad's emotional state was in the days and certainly the hours after the assassination. But in terms of the details, where did your dad actually land on all of this? And was there a private point of view that differed from a public point of view, or was that all one and the same?
No, you know, and it's very interesting. It's a great question, because what I chose to do, because I covered this in depth in the book, and it's his voice. What I tried to do is let him tell his experiences of that day.
Sure.
Because, you know, I didn't want to get in the way of it, and I didn't want to be interpreting it and things like that. And what I think happened is that his best sort of memory of everything is what's, and I don't mean it arrogantly, but it's what's in this book. And it comes from the tapes. Because at this time, he was as sharp as could be. Mm-hmm. And I think as you know, sort of things went on in his life, and they were difficult. Bobby was murdered, and then, you know, he lost for governor. I think his recollections are not as sharp if you go later. So I think that's where you get the different, you know, the different versions. Mm-hmm. So what I did for this book is I went with what he said on the tapes at this time, because they were to Sandra Van Oker, and they were not for publication, you know. Right. And it was, he and Bobby did these tapes together, although it's my dad speaking, but they were doing it for a book he and Bobby had planned to do. Mm-hmm. And so he's very clear, you know, in this memory, which I think is the best memory we have, is they were in the car behind, and he heard, you know, he heard the three shots. And what he remembers distinctly is, although he doesn't remember saying it, but he obviously did because Dave reported it, but he said the final shot, you know, lifted John Kennedy out of his seat, and he said shook him like a rag doll.
Yeah.
And he said, just from my experience in the war, he said, I said he's dead. Mm-hmm. And he said, he had no memory of saying that, but Dave said that's what he said. And then in this book, we really go into, I go into depth from his perspective what it was like.
And this is the book you're...
It's not
the
gory,
book you're,
but it's quite, you feel like you're in a movie because... Yeah. You know, they wanted to take the president's body out of there, and according to Texas law, they weren't allowed to.
Mm-hmm.
So this very moving story, and it's the Dallas chapter of how they essentially they stole the president's body.
Yeah.
And they, you know, and he tells what it was like. He said they, you know, he remembers he threw the guy out of the ambulance, and he drove the ambulance, which is scary all by itself because my dad driving is frightening.
Wait, this is, I've never heard this. But, your dad drove the ambulance with the president in it?
Yes, that was his memory of it.
Wow.
And so what I do in the book is I just repeat it. You know, my editor and I decided to not try to interpret. We just let mm-hmm. him tell the story.
Yeah.
Because it's so powerful that you don't need, you know, anybody else talking. So then he talks about how they got to Love Field and they get the body on, and they think Johnson is gone because his agreement with Johnson was that Johnson would leave. And so he's thinking he's getting on Air Force Two.
Yeah.
And he's got the body, and he orders the pilot, Godfrey, orders them to take off because he's terrified that they're going to be arrested at any moment.
Oh my God.
And he tells this story about, you know, he's numb and he's afraid Jackie's going to have a heart attack because she's going into shock. And he's afraid the police are going to come up and shoot the tires out of the plane while they try to take off. And he gives the order, you know, because he really was that powerful in the Kennedy administration.
Yeah.
He says, we're out of here, take off. And it comes back to him through Godfrey, who was Kennedy's guy, and it was ironically the press secretary that my dad had just had let go,
mm-hmm.
but it was Kilduff, who my dad had fired, you know, the previous to the Dallas trip, but he let him take this last trip. And Kilduff sends the word back, tell Ken O'Donnell he's not in charge of the country anymore.
Wow.
And he said that was the first time he realized they were on Air Force One, because he assumed Johnson had left. He didn't know Johnson was on the plane.
Yeah.
And so then this whole chapter goes through this very moving moment where he has to go talk to Johnson, and just he keeps using the word he uses repeatedly is numb.
Mm-hmm.
And he tried to get through to Bobby, but he couldn't, and you know, they go through the whole swearing in, and there's some, I sent you those pictures, very moving pictures.
Yeah.
And that it turns out, you know, it's ironic because at the time they were upset that Johnson wanted to be sworn in on the plane. But my dad admits later, and we talk about this in the book, that, you know, it was a brilliant political decision on Johnson's part, and that's why he mm-hmm. did it. Because what Johnson wanted to show the world, less the country, more the world, you know, going back to our Cuban Missile Crisis discussion, but he wanted to show the world that the ship of state was going straight ahead.
Yeah.
You know, we'd lost a president, but the ship of state, the United States, was fine.
Mm-hmm.
And we're moving straight ahead. And he said Johnson was right. He said I was wrong, and Johnson was right to do what he did. But he said it took him a long time to realize that. I mean, it took him being all the way on the other side for him to realize that. You know, it took him like a year or so to realize that Johnson had done the exact right thing.
Yeah, and that, he must have.
At the time, they were furious.
Yeah, and your dad must have been in a complete state of shock anyway. I mean, especially getting on Air Force One.
Shocked because they had no, you know, he said they were numb. And, you know, afterwards he said Johnson told all these stories about, you know, the Kennedy people on the plane being rude to the Johnson people. And he said, what Kennedy people? There were three of us.
Yeah.
Wow. You know, one was dead, and then it was Dave, Jackie, and me.
Yeah.
There were no Kennedy people.
Right. And then so, in fact, your dad is in that famous photo of LBJ taking the oath with Jackie there. And I believe, it's one of the most striking photos in the history of the United States, that this is a major, major changeover, even though LBJ did pick up a lot of the Kennedy agenda, at least in that first year. It was a huge, monumental change in American government as far as the differences, as we talked about earlier, the difference between LBJ and JFK. And so, and your dad was right there witnessing all of that in what can only be termed a state of extreme stress. I would imagine that would be unlike anything most of us have ever experienced ever, to be in that position.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny, and I realized that it was really tough to, I have to say that there's two chapters. One is, I don't know what you name it, so I just named it Dallas, November 22nd. And then the second part of that is, chapter after that, chapter six, is A Long Journey Home.
Yeah.
And it talks about what they went through on the plane.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this transition of power. You know, Johnson, as he should have, called a national security meeting, and they come back, and Bill Moyers, a great Bill Moyers, comes back and says, Kenny, you know, the president is holding a national security meeting. My father just, you know, Jackie didn't want him to leave. So he said, I just said to him, you know, I don't have the stomach for it. I just can't.
Yeah.
And he said it was his intention to leave the president. You know, when they returned, he said, my job was over. Yeah. My job was to get Jackie safely into Bobby's hands.
Mm.
And he said, I didn't intend to stay. But he said, Johnson wouldn't let me leave. And he said, I realized afterwards, Johnson was right to make him stay. Because he needed him there. He had, you know, he understood the country, you know, his administration. This was all going to be a transition. You can't have all these guys leave. Because then the message to the country is, well, something's wrong with this guy. All the Kennedy people left the next day. What the hell?
Yeah.
You know, and so that's why Johnson wanted all the Kennedy people to stay on, to show, again, that shift of state is moving forward. It's that consistency.
Right.
And then he had this kind of crazy idea that, in my view, that he could make them all into Johnson men. And that was just never going to happen.
No.
You know, but that was his belief in himself was such that, you know, once I get them in here, they'll become my guys. And that just never happened.
Mm-hmm. So,
and there's a great story, which I think you'd appreciate. I think this is a very sort of shows a lot of what the country was going through. There was a party. This is Johnson is now president. My dad's back to work at the White House. Bobby has transitioned. Now he's running for Senate because he's just got to get out of here. And they decide to do a party at the F Street Club. You know where that is in Washington? It's still there. And it's Jackie's first outing since the president was murdered.
Hmm.
And it's a big deal, needless to say. And everyone's going to be there. And there's some, and I believe, I want to say Camelot or something like that was showing afterwards. I mean, they're going to something afterwards. So everybody is in black tie and the gowns. And you remember how people dressed then.
Oh, sure.
But my dad was at work with LBJ. So they arrived at the F Street Club in suits, business suits. And he said to him, it was so poignant because Bobby was there. And he said, you know, Jackie was there. And she looked, you know, beautiful considering what she'd just been through, you know, in the last year. And everyone is surrounding she and Bobby, and all the swishy people are over there. And the President of the United States, Lyndon Johnson, comes in. And Bob, not one person went over to him. Nobody looked up. Wow. Nobody walked over. He just stood there, and he said, my father said he stood there in his baggy suit, and he did not, what would you do? He didn't know what to do with himself, so he and my dad walked over, and they went to the bar. And he, my dad said, I was going to go see Jackie, but I couldn't just leave him there, you know? So he said, we went over to the bar and had a drink, and he said not one person turned around, came over, or anything, didn't even acknowledge they were there.
Mm-hmm.
And he said after a drink, they were all going to this other event afterwards, and my dad had obviously been invited, but he said the president turned to him and said, I guess you're going with them too, because everyone was invited but me.
Yeah, wow.
And my father said, I just looked at him. He said, no, I wasn't invited either, because he said, I didn't want him to feed, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so the president said, well, would you come back with me to the White House and eat dinner with me? And my dad was like, sure. You know, he didn't know what else to do. So, I mean, he said, I couldn't just leave him there. So he said, we left, and we're in the limo going back to the White House. And they weren't talking. My dad was not a chatty guy anyway. But he said, I didn't know what do you say?
Yeah.
And he said, finally, the president turned to him and said, you know, Kenny, I mean, after all, I am the president of the United States, you know. They couldn't sit that high. I mean, I didn't want it this way.
Yeah, yeah.
But wow. I am the president of the United States. And my dad said, I felt terrible because I thought, yeah, he is. You know, somebody could have said, hello, Mr. President. Mm-hmm. And he said they went back, they had dinner and too much to drink. And then he said he got home late that night and he called Bobby at Hickory Hill and he said, I just gave him hell. And, you know, Bobby said, I said to Bobby, you pick up the phone and you apologize to him. I don't care what your feelings are. He's the president. You know, I said, you don't do that. And he said, Bobby said it just never occurred to him. He just didn't think about it.
What was
and,
a I'm
great
sorry,
story because it shows you, you know, it wasn't easy to be Lyndon Johnson in those days.
No, absolutely not. I mean, no one would envy that position to take over after, you know, it'd be like if you're a comedian and George Carlin opens for you. Where do you go from there? You know what I mean?
Comedian, you understand.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's the same kind of thing. And with that kind of setup. So LBJ certainly needed to hit the ground running after the assassination. Fast forwarding a little bit, obviously your dad ran Bobby Kennedy's 1968 campaign, and but I, you know, and I'm skipping over.
He was his kind of right hand guy, but he never actually was the campaign manager.
Oh, okay.
And everybody always asked me why, and the reason is, and this is interesting because this was a point of friction between them.
Hmm.
Bobby wanted my dad to be to him what my dad was for Jack.
I see.
But my dad felt that two things. One, that Bobby needed his own guy.
Mm-hmm.
He needed his own Ken O'Donnell.
Yeah.
And Bobby's argument was, I have him. It's you. Hello. And but the other concern my dad had was that his politics Jack Kennedy was not a liberal, as you know. You know, he was much more conservative, and so was my dad.
Yeah.
And again, not today's terminology. I'm talking about at that period of time.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And Bobby, as you know, became much more liberal by 1968 because the country was changing.
Yeah.
And my dad worried that his view was not, you know, he wasn't current enough for what Bobby needed. And Bobby just refused to accept that. He just, you know, Bobby, I mean, he said, my dad said once, I love Bobby, but he can be a pain in the ass because he doesn't hear no if he doesn't want to hear it. And so he ended up working on the campaign anyway because Bobby just refused to hear my dad's sort of logical, which is that you need a younger generation of guys, and the country's in a different place than it was in 1960.
Sure, yeah. And this is interesting that your dad recognized that shortcoming in himself, that he couldn't bring that younger attitude to that campaign, which was all about, I mean, 100% about young people and about Vietnam. And it seems that is a level of self-consciousness that you don't typically see in politics, where you go, oh, wait, that's kind of out of my depth. No one does that anymore. They say, oh, yeah, sure, I'll take the job.
No.
Give me a check. You know?
No, and it's very funny because, you know, Bobby, when he went up to the Senate, he and Jackie wanted my dad to go run his, you know, work for him in New York or go work for him in his Senate office.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad, he could be so funny, but he just looked at Bobby. He said, "I don't want one of those little pocket things. You know, those government people. I'm not one of those guys."
Right.
You know, he said, I'm the guy with Jack who's the outrider. You know what I mean? I'm not the guy in the office.
Mm-hmm.
And Bobby was like, "Oh, that's ridiculous. You know, if I can do it, you can do it."
Yeah.
You know,
was your,
my dad understood that about himself, for better or worse.
Was your dad at the Ambassador Hotel?
No. And actually that's how I end launching LBJ because, he was in Washington at the Mayflower Hotel, another place I know you know well. It's a beautiful old hotel.
Oh, sure.
And he was here because he was doing stuff. They were setting up some stuff for Bobby on this end, and Dad still was very tight with the DNC. And so, you know, he was running sort of the national stuff for Bobby. And it's just this wonderful story at the end of the book where he talks to Bobby on the phone, and I want to see, if you don't mind, it's a short just section. I would love to, if I can find the page.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Read just it's a few words to you.
Yeah, go ahead.
Because I think he says it better than, you know, than I could.
Okay, sure.
So there, the day would come, Kennedy declared, when the break between Johnson and Kennedy over Vietnam was inevitable. Bobby chose the path he chose to challenge Johnson, not for some personal ego-driven purpose, but rather because he knew he had to stop the war raging in Vietnam, the war raging in our cities, and he was the one to bring the country together. Kenny recalled the last time he and Bobby spoke, and this is a quote from my dad. "He had just won California, and he said to me shortly before going down to give his acceptance speech, you know, he said, 'Kenny, do you think I'm doing the right thing, dividing the party and maybe the country like this?' I said to him, and I meant what I said, 'Bobby, you are the only man who can bring this country together and change the direction in which we are going. You are the only man who can bring blacks and whites together, and the only man who can stop this awful war and save our country.'"
Yeah.
There was a moment of silence, and then in typical Bobby fashion, he said, "Well, gosh, when you put it that way..." Both laughed. He then said, "Thanks, Kenny." We hung up. I never spoke to him again.
Unbelievable. Yeah, that just gave me chills. That's wow. I you know, I can't even imagine the sense of loss and devastation after both Dallas and California, with both those being kind of bookends of the 1960s in a way, in terms of tragedy. You had JFK, Martin Luther King, and then Bobby Kennedy, and your dad basically sitting in the front row for all of that. And then knowing that, and I don't mean to be indelicate about this, but both of your parents...
I'm a straight shooter. You can say whatever.
Well, I mean, the official word is that both of your parents died of alcohol-related symptoms. And I tend to think, in a more romantic sense, about their deaths and some of the reactions, obviously, of some of the people who were also very close to the Kennedys, who went on to not live very long after those years. And I have more of this analysis that they died of broken hearts, and not necessarily from a, you know, like a relationship point of view, but from a friendship and potential and the promise that they offered, and then having that all ripped away, that has to be heartbreaking on a very profound level. And I tend to believe that your parents were more impacted by that, and alcohol was just kind of secondary. That was the method.
I think that's really true. And I think that for both of them, you know, my mother was very, I mean, she was devoted to my dad, and she was devoted to Bobby. And, you know, they had really, and this is something I think even I continue to learn, and when I wrote The Irish Brotherhood, I realized the extent to which, you know, they were devoted to Jack's success, and they had this vision for what he could do for the country. And then when he was murdered, they sort of never, you know, they never quite recovered, but then everybody got behind Bobby, and then it happened again. And I really think that they did die of broken hearts, because they both died, as I said, so young, 49 and 53. And I just think that they never recovered from, especially Bobby's death. I think they never recovered from Jack. But Bobby was just, I don't even know mentally how you sort of work your way through that. You don't want it happens twice. And I think for my dad, the hardest thing for him was he felt somehow, especially with Jack, he felt responsible. And that he, it was his job. He ran the Secret Service. It was his job. His last conversation with Jack as they're getting on the plane to go to Dallas is, you know, Jack talks about it being Kennedy weather. And the last thing he says to my father is, you know, Kenny, you always have my back. And my father said, and I always did till I didn't. And, you know, and the reason I wanted to end the book the way I did launching LBJ with his last conversation with Bobby was because what tore him apart when Bobby died is that he felt he had pushed him into running. And see, Teddy and Steve Smith and those guys wanted Bobby to wait because they thought this 68 was fraught. It was a difficult time in the country. They wanted him to wait to 72. And my dad was one of the hardcore people that really pushed him to run. And I really believe it haunted him because, you know, he felt maybe he should have waited. You know, I don't think he was able to ever let that go. Mm-hmm. And I think that was why one of the tragedies was, you know, how you hit that sort of sense that maybe I should have done something else. Maybe I should have stopped this. But, you know, you and I know life doesn't work that way, sadly.
Yeah, yeah. It's such a sad story, the way things ended up turning out. Were you cognizant of you know, what happened when your parents died? I mean, were you aware of what was going on at that point in time? And if so, I mean, how did you take
and
that?
And that's one of the things I started, A Common Good. I addressed it in A Common Good in the introduction, which, I'm not sure I should have or not. I got a lot of grief about it.
Really?
But I felt that you couldn't, I needed to address it for myself because it's always, you know, as a kid, you just don't understand, you know.
Yeah.
But I have come to realize something. Senator Kennedy, when my parents died, Senator Kennedy kind of stepped in and really, you know, he was terrific to me. He really was sort of a father figure kind of guiding me so much. And he taught me something very important, which is that he said, don't focus on the sadness. And maybe this is what he learned himself, you know, because he went through such tragedy. He said, what I've learned is, he said, I always focus on the good days and the things they accomplished in life, and I don't focus on the tragedy. Mm. Because if I focus on the tragedy, I can't go forward the next day.
Wow.
And so what I've learned to do is now, as I'm writing my third book on this sort of era, is to focus on the amazing story and the things they accomplished and what great guys they were and how much they believed in the country, and then use that to inspire another generation rather than the tragedy, because I think the tragedy, you know, can consume you otherwise. I think the senator was right about that.
Mm-hmm. And you actually worked for Ted Kennedy, didn't you? Because, I mean, the reason I'm, one of the reasons I'm asking, too, is that a lot of current analysis of the Kennedy brothers is kind of turning out that that Ted Kennedy was actually the smartest politician, actually the best at politics of the three brothers, who, obviously, of Bobby, Jack, and Ted. That Ted was the one who had the real talent for politics. And how did you? Well, where do you land on that? Because I don't know. It's hard for me to say because Bobby was a master and a pit bull and all these things. But, you know, and I also admire Ted Kennedy quite a bit. So where's your analysis on that?
It's interesting because I say this to people, you know, it's clear that Jack Kennedy didn't have the patience for the Senate, and you know, he wasn't going to stay there long. I mean, he would never have been what Ted Kennedy was. He could never have been that senator that stayed there forever because he just had this need. He knew what he wanted to do. He wanted to be in the White House, and you know, that was his plan.
Yeah.
And I think that was always his plan.
Well, you know,
and
also just real quick about Jack. I mean, didn't he have the sense that he was going to die young too, and that might have accelerated his ambitions?
I believe that. My dad talked about that, and he said he felt that Jack had this kind of, and maybe it was from all the illnesses he had growing up. And it's extraordinary that he got up every day, considering how sick he was.
Yeah.
But he made the most of every single day, you know, and he had this sort of driving sort of what I call that Kennedy need to keep moving, you know, and Bobby was very similar, but Bobby was not, you know, he was not, my dad said he was just the least politically savvy person you ever wanted to meet. That was not his thing. And he never planned to be the out front guy. He was always going to be behind the scenes. And the only reason he became the politician was because his brother died. You know, that his brother was murdered, and he had to step into that role. And he didn't, where else do you go? He didn't want to be attorney general, so he was either going to run for governor of Massachusetts or Senate from New York. And I think with Ted is that he had just the right skill set. You know, he really loved the Senate. He loved the give and take. He loved the relationships. You know, I really believe, I don't think he wanted to be president. I think everybody around him wanted him to be president. Mm-hmm. But I think he loved being a great senator.
Yeah.
But I think he always had to live with that sort of expectation that, you know, you're up next. And I'm sure that had to be a real burden, I would imagine.
Oh, my God. I can't even imagine after 1968, the burden must have been just the weight of the world. I can't even imagine being in this place.
Yeah. And you have all these kids who, you know, who you're also responsible for. And then what people don't realize is that he also had a lot of kids that weren't his kids, kids like me and a lot of others who he felt responsible for because their parents had served his brothers.
Yeah.
So he, you know, one of my favorite stories about him is I was at American University when I was working for him. And, you know, honestly, I just couldn't do the tuition on this particular semester. So I was going to have to do what probably most people have to do these days, especially, but, you know, was drop out and then do it another way.
Yeah.
And I told somebody, I don't even know who I told in the office, but I didn't tell him because I didn't want to upset him. So anyway, he got wind of it, and then I was at work, and I got a phone call, and it was from the bursar at American University. It was a clerk, whoever it is behind the thing that takes when you pay your you know, wasn't when you pay your bill.
Yeah, when you pay your tuition.
And they said, Miss O'Donnell, you know, this is so and so from American University. We have Senator Edward Kennedy in front of us in line, and he's got his checkbook. He's got a check is what it was, and he's going to pay your tuition, but I just need to make sure that's okay with you.
Wow.
And I was like, how the hell did he even know? You know, I couldn't believe it. But I thought, you know, instead of him coming to me and saying, you know, blah, 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 you know, any nonsense, he just thought, well, typical Kennedy. Okay, well, I got to take care of it. So he did.
What a great story.
And then our agreement was that when I could, I'd pay him back, which I did. And then he sent it back to me because he said the point was the lesson, not that he needed the money.
Wow.
It was to teach me when someone loans you money, you know, this is this kind of thing. You know, it's just a great story. You know, it was just a lesson that he had done this for me and I needed to pay him back.
Yeah.
And so it's a little story, but it's a good story, I think.
Yeah. In fact, I always thought that the Affordable Care Act should have been named after Ted Kennedy because he did so much as far as getting that so close to I mean, he died before it was finally passed, but he did so much to get it to that point. Obviously that was one of his wheelhouse issues was healthcare.
Right.
And thanks in part to his efforts, I have healthcare now. Millions of people also have healthcare. And in fact, you know, I always play on my show, I always play the sound of Rachel Maddow talking about how I won the award for the Rachel Maddow headline of the week. This was back when the Affordable Care Act was being debated. And so I actually got a mention on the Rachel Maddow show. But the reason she mentioned me is because I wrote a piece for the Huffington Post in which I said the Affordable Care Act should be named after Ted Kennedy. So it's this weird conglomeration of the three names all coming up at the same time and me just going, wow, I can't believe that actually happened. So I constantly beat it to death on my show.
I have to say to you, maybe this is, you know, if it was named after Ted Kennedy, maybe Trump wouldn't have been so eager to destroy it.
That's entirely possible.
Probably, you know what? He probably would have supported it if it was named after Ted Kennedy.
So the last thing I wanted to ask you, Helen, is the thing I keep thinking about in hearing about your body of work and all the books you've written and how they've kind of centered around your dad's career and the Kennedy years and so on. You know, the great documentarian Ken Burns always talks about how After he did the Civil War documentary, it was going to be very difficult for him to dig into another war story. And he eventually went on to do the World War II documentary series called The War, and then eventually Vietnam. And so he did get into it again, but he said that the reason he didn't want to do it again at the time in the early 90s was because it was so hard to be steeped in the war and the tragedy around it 24/7 as a filmmaker. Have you found that, you know, in addition to obviously connecting in this very unique way with your father and with his life and times, do you find also that the grief that surrounds his life, especially in the 60s and into the 70s, you know, is too much to handle sometimes? Do you feel like, wow, I really need to write about rainbows and puppies next time, because all of this grief is, do you find that?
It's funny because I have to say it's a great question, because especially my siblings, you know, they get very emotional. You know, I mean, my older brother, Kenny Jr., he said to me, he was reading The Irish Brotherhood the other, you know, this was when it first came out, and he called me and he said, you know what, I'm so mad at you because you make me cry every time I read this book.
Wow.
Because, you know, he remembers all this. And mm-hmm. for me, it can be overwhelming, but what I've learned to do is to focus on, and I'm really adamant about this, I try to focus on the good things they did, the happy days, the amazing, you know, even the things where it's sort of up or down, and the mistakes they made, because they, you know, they didn't get it right all the time, and they also did crazy stuff, you know, if you look at some of their Hollywood stuff and some of those days. But, you know, what I try to focus on is how much, even though they all lived very short lives, how much they accomplished.
Yeah.
And then that keeps you from focusing too much on the tragedies, because I think the what-ifs would, you know, I think they'd eat you alive, which I think they did to a lot of those people, and I think you have to stay clear of that.
Yeah.
And I have, in this material, I mean, I have there's a couple more things stories I'd like to tell, and then I feel like my dad's, all of his tapes and everything is out there.
Yeah.
And then I think I'd switch and to something else, because I think that my job is to sort of be his voice, because he didn't get a chance to do it. And then once I've reached the end of that, then it's out there. As Chris Matthews said, then you told the story.
Right.
And people will have to judge.
You know, it's interesting. When I got to meet Ted Sorensen, one of the things he was talking about at the time and was very passionate about was there were a series of movies that came out maybe 10 years ago, 10, 12 years ago. I forget exactly when, but one of them was, I think, a more recent one, which is based on the Bill O'Reilly book, Killing Kennedy. And then there was some other documentary series that was done by, I want to say, someone who's involved with the reality television shows. And the name is slipping out of my head because my head is so full of Russian names right now, so I can't remember the guy, but there was a series of movies. Yeah, they were kind of smear pieces on, and these were in the form of miniseries for TV, smear pieces about the Kennedy years, and Ted Sorensen was really upset about all of the myriad inaccuracies in them. Did you have the same reaction to some of those pieces, that geez, this is kind of anti-Kennedy propaganda and shouldn't be out there? It's completely inaccurate. And I know, in fact, Ted Sorensen campaigned actively against those movies or those miniseries. Did you have the same reaction?
You know, it's funny because I remember that. They really went, you know, there was a time when people wouldn't dare do that because of, you know, or if they did it, they had to expect an onslaught. You know, the Kennedys were a little more, you know, they were more centralized than the older generation was still around. And they would go after these guys, you know, much to their credit. And nowadays, you know, with the media being what it is, it's very hard because, you know, it's hard to find the outlets where they actually come from. And also, you know, the Kennedys don't have the power they used to shut some of this nonsense down.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I find that a lot is sometimes I talk to people and I'm amazed at how ignorant they are about the facts.
Yeah.
So, what I try to do is convince them they need to, you know, if you have to read my book, but read Chris Matthews' book or Doris Kearns, or you know what I mean? Deal with facts, not made up stories.
Yeah.
But it's not easy. I even see that on my Facebook page. You know, I'm amazed sometimes some of the stuff that gets out there, and you just have to, relentlessly go at it with the facts. You can't allow people to create their own reality.
I mean, did they? And I'm just now researching now, seeing this. It was Joel Surnow who created the Kiefer Sutherland's show 24, who produced this miniseries called The Kennedys, and that was the one I was specifically referencing that Ted Sorensen was really angry about. And so did
it was a bunch. I think that's the one I'm thinking of. It was awful, wasn't it?
Terrible. Just terrible. It was basically an exploitative thing about Kennedy's extramarital affairs and so on, and it came out around 2010, I want to say, and it was widely panned as being just bogus. And yeah, I'm just curious because you're so steeped in all of your dad's writings and memoirs of that period of time. Did they even bother to talk to you about this documentary series when they were producing it?
No, I think they know that they, I've never talked to any of those guys because I think if you are going to, they know if you're going to deal with facts, they don't want to talk to you because then they can't make it up.
Yeah.
And so I never heard from any of those guys. and to me, you know, as Matthew said, that's a real sign of whether somebody's really doing it right or not. You know what I mean? If they're not going to get in touch with the people that actually know the facts, you know, they're just, they're going to just make it up as they go. And I think you have to, you know, my dad used to say, because, you know, he had to put up with even a lot of it in his later years, and it really ticked him off, you know, and he would sort of go after people. But it's harder to do now, and I think that, you know, what you kind of have to do is, Senator Kennedy said his approach was to straight arm them, which I guess, you know, and because, you know, if they didn't, you know, you can't deal with them because these people want to just sell whatever it is, you know?
Yeah, right.
And it's interesting because one of the things that, and this is something I want to mention, my next project is called The Watchman Cometh. And it's going to be, and it'll be out, you know, a year from now. And it's about Bobby and Dad and those guys during the late 1950s when they were working at the Rackets Committee and running for president behind the scenes.
Wow.
And it's not sort of the tedious part of the story, but it's going to be kind of whodunit part of it, you know. And what I'd like to do is develop it into a 6 to 12 episode series for, say, Netflix or Amazon or something like that.
Oh yeah.
And several people said to me, well, if you're going to do that, you got to fictionalize it because otherwise it's very hard to get these things done. But I thought, you know, if you really, you know, we talked earlier about the film 13 Days, you know, you could really take some of this material and do a really great series, and you don't have to go into nonsense. You know, there's enough meat there on the bone.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, that's wonderful news. And in fact, the last question I was going to ask you, Helen, is what's next for you? What are you working on next? And we have the answer to that question already. So
you have The Watchman Cometh, and then the last piece, which is going to come out in September, August 2020, timed on purpose, of course, is going to be called Jack Kennedy, the President. And it's going to be my dad's tapes, the same thing like LBJ, but this will be the White House years.
I see.
And I thought it was important because I thought, especially as we face this election, which I think is vitally important.
Oh, yes.
People need to get out and vote, not just complain, actually vote. But I think that we need to see what we should be looking for in a real president.
Yeah, yeah.
And what, you know, what we should expect, and you know, which is not sort of made up reality TV nonsense. But, you know, I'm not saying it has to be somebody, you can't find another Jack Kennedy, but I think that you can see the outlines of what we should be looking for as we look at this, you know, lineup of candidates.
Right, right. And here's my last question. This is officially my last question, I promise, Helen, and it's a quickie one. Do you have any record as to whether your dad at any point bumped into Stephanie Miller's dad, who, of course, was Bill Miller, Barry Goldwater's running mate in 1964?
Oh, I met her sister at the thing, and I don't know. And it's funny because I thought she would really be interested in this book because there's so much about Goldwater in here.
Yeah.
And I took a lot of reporting from Rolly Evans and Bob Novak, but I didn't. I'm going to have to go back on the tapes and see if I find his name because she asked me, or her sister asked me to check it out. So if I find something, I'm going to let you know.
That would be an amazing thing if that actually happened, that meeting, even if it was just for a couple of drinks somewhere on Connecticut Avenue. That would have been a great story.
And my dad was very detailed. That's one thing, you know, with these tapes, you know, they're incredibly detailed. Yeah. You know, he had a photographic memory. He never wrote anything down. But it's just on the tapes, he goes through, you know, places and people and who was doing what. You know, there are times you sort of go, oh, my Lord.
Yeah.
But now, as I'm working on all this, you know, he comes up with these names. You can track them back. Mm-hmm. So that's why you never know. So I'm going to see what I can dig up.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, Helen, thank you so much for your 2 hours of time. I can't
thank you.
Thank you enough, Hal.
Can I tell you one funny LBJ story?
Sure. I'm always in for another funny LBJ story. That
now,
sounds
this
good.
Is very funny, but I can't tell you for a fact. This is a story I've been told, so we have to know. This is not from the tapes.
Okay.
This is a story that has come down to us, so I don't want to. I just think it's a great story.
All right.
And you'll appreciate it because you just appreciate these guys. But, you know, my dad and LBJ would often at the end of the day, and he did this with the president as well, but he would hang back and hang around the Oval Office and, you know, they'd discuss things and things like that. But LBJ would sort of get into these kind of dark moods. And so my dad would stay there and they would have a few pops, and a couple times it went on for a while and, they'd sit around and, you know, on this particular night, my dad finally was like, look, I gotta go home. I'm going to be in trouble. I gotta go, you know? And, the president said, I'll take you home. And he said, no, you can't take me home. I mean, I'll just, you know, he had my dad as a driver and all that. The brother down, of course, they obviously had enough to drink.
Yeah.
So they head out, and he's going to give my dad a ride home. You know, and it's not a small entourage, as you know. Uh-huh. It's not like today, but it was still large. And they pull up into our neighborhood, which is, it's kind of late now. You know, everybody's got kids in the
Where was the neighborhood? Where did where did your family live at that time? Where in the D.C. area?
They lived in towards Bethesda. Bethesda off Massachusetts Avenue.
Ah, the mean streets of Bethesda. I see.
Yes, you know that area. It's a neighborhood, you know what I mean?
Right,
and
right.
So, and it was not a high, you know, it was a nice house, but it was
beautiful.
A neighborhood.
Yeah, beautiful.
Then. And so they pull up, and the whole entourage, of course, they wake up the entire neighborhood, and they're both inebriated, as my mother said. And they get to the door, and, you know, my father wouldn't have a key to the house if he had, you know, if he had a gun in his head, so he has to ring the bell, naturally. And, so my mother was not a happy camper, and she was not having it. She opened the door, and she looked at the two of them. She pointed, and she was a small person, but kind of fiery. You know, she's a great athlete. And she pointed at my father. She said, you, go upstairs. And then she pointed at the president of the United States and said, and you go home to Lady Bird, now. And she slammed the door in his face.
That's so great. Oh, my God. You're probably the only person in the world who could boss LBJ around at that point, right?
Well, that's what he was dumbfounded. He kept ringing the bell, and he was like, Ginny. And my father said, brave soul that he was, he knew, you know, my mother was in charge. He knew when he was licked. So he went up and he went to bed. He was no foolish.
That's so
great. He just left him out there.
Oh, my God.
That was it, you know, and so
what a great story.
I guess the president reminded my father several times because he just thought it was, thought it was a hilarious story to tell, you know,
right.
It got better. My father said it got better with each telling.
Yeah. Well, you know, this has been such a treat, Helen, such an honor. And, you know, the next time you got something going on, please keep in touch. And I'd love to have you on anytime.
Oh, thank you, and I hope this was, I hope I wasn't boring you to death, because
there's so many stories
to tell, but you're so wonderful to talk to. You have great insight.
No, never boring. Never, ever, ever boring. I could just, you know what, like I said, I could go another couple hours talking about all kinds of details we could get into, but I thank you so much for your time, and I'm looking forward to us chatting again real soon.
And same here, and hopefully as soon as my box arrives, the books, I will send it your way with the signature.
Oh, I can't wait. I can't wait to dig into launching LBJ.
And then you have to tell me what you think. Email me and tell me what you think.
Absolutely. I'll give you my honest opinion.
Please do. Oh,
all
wonderful.
Right. Helen, thank you so much for your time. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you. Thank you.
Wow. Wow, wow, wow. I feel like a kid in a candy store. If you're really into studying the Kennedy years like I am, that was a hell of a conversation. Okay, make sure to click the link in the description below to pick up your copy of Launching LBJ by the great Helen O'Donnell. I'll also link to 13 Days, which I highly recommend, especially with the modern context of the Trump crisis. Okay, next week we're going to talk with Professor Tom Nichols of the Naval War College and the author of The Death of Expertise. Oh, by the way, he's also a 5-time Jeopardy champion. Meanwhile, I'll be back with the Big Thursday Show and Jody Hamilton tomorrow. All right, folks, take it easy. We'll see you next time. Bye-bye.